Episode 7, Part 2. Conformity and compliance versus conscience and consistency. And spoiler alert, in this episode, the latter prevails. Critical thinking question. How could disobedience to authority save millions of lives? Imagine the movie The Matrix, with a rather surprising alternate ending. Just like the original, this alternate version progresses up to the point where Morpheus gives Neo the red pill in The Matrix, and then Neo becomes conscious in the human power plant in his little pod. The monitors in the power plant detect his consciousness, remove his plugs, and Neo is flushed. Then, in the next scene, aboard the Nebuchadnezzar, Morpheus's ship, Neo and Morpheus have a discussion about this real world that Neo has just become aware of. And Neo says, "You know, this is all very eye-opening, and thanks for the opportunity and all to participate in the movement to save mankind." And by saving mankind, he's talking about from an entity that had enslaved mankind, largely because of the delusion that mankind had had that this entity was their servant, which adds kind of a tragicomic element to both the original film and this alternate version. But then Neo says, "Yeah, well, all that aside, very eye-opening, but maybe you could just drop me back off at the pod there. I think I'm just going to sit there and splash around in that goo." The end. While this would make for a completely unsatisfying motion picture, it also suggests an unfortunate ending for one of our favorite protagonists. At this point, we are only left to infer that he has chosen a contradictory existence, an existence of self-denial and emotionally convenient rationalizations for his situation. Like Neo waking up in that pool of goo, many of us, regardless of time or place or circumstances, have come to, are in the process of coming to, or in the future will come to a similar realization about our reality, which certainly is not as severe and unfortunate as his, but that certainly doesn't mean it couldn't use a lot of improving. At that point, we're faced with a choice. Do we do something, or do we do nothing? In today's episode, I'm going to have a discussion with a friend of mine who, 3 months ago, seemed to be in one of the most undesirable and impossible situations as far as doing something was concerned. On May 4th, 2009, he was serving as a petty officer second class in the United States Navy when he issued a request for designation as a conscientious objector and subsequent discharge from the Navy. On the necessary application, when asked for a description of the nature of his belief leading to this request, he wrote, "The basis of my belief is that the ultimate violation of natural law, and consequently of natural rights, is to use force without a direct personal threat of physical violence being visibly enacted against your person, your property, or the person or property of another individual present with you. Generally known as the non-aggression axiom, this principle is the foundation of my morality, and it is because of this I cannot but conclude that war is immoral. War, in contrast to an individual's self-defense, inherently involves the formation of a group of persons who enact systematic violence against another faction whether or not they have been personally threatened or attacked. The necessary escalation of violence that is inherent to waging war directly contradicts the moral obligation that compels me to preserve human life. My adherence to natural law is rooted in the belief that each human acts as their own moral agent, and that therefore, what any individual holds as their highest value should be respected insofar as it does not infringe upon the natural rights of others. I believe it is almost universally accepted that humans value their right to continue living as the most important function of their existence. That this line of reasoning sounds awkward or circular is simply evidence that it is the de facto basis for almost all human action. Although few, if any, persons would argue against the theoretical value of human life, the problem arises when individuals or groups do not weigh their actions against the criterion of whether or not they infringe upon another person's highest value, most frequently, their right to continue living. It is with this mindset that I cannot affirm any manner of just war theory because it intentionally jeopardizes human lives that may not otherwise have been threatened. Whether my moral premises apply to our current wars, any past wars, or any conceivable future war, no warring party can be justified. I accept that, from such a strict moral standpoint, the ease of defending the sovereignty of any government is severely compromised, as it would ultimately rely upon the success of individuals defending themselves and their property. Even at such potential cost, I cannot set aside my moral beliefs for the sake of expediency. Therefore, whether on foreign soil or American, in aggression or in defense of government, I am convinced beyond doubt of the immorality of war. So, that was what he wrote back in May, and today the good news is that Daniel Lachenmacher is not in the Navy anymore. He's free. This show is not intended as a tribute to him, nor would he want that. He was faced with a choice. Conformity and compliance and the convenience associated with those things on the one hand, and conscience and consistency on the other. For somebody who had realized much of what I have been talking about in previous episodes, including the philosophy of liberty, and the principle of non-aggression, there really is no choice at all. But what's important is, if this person could free himself from that situation, from the belly of that beast, the question you should be asking yourself today is, where are you? And what can you start to do? What actions can you take? I don't want to just throw out the problems of public education and not provide solutions. So, Daniel's story is, at the very least, motivational.
The appeal to force is being answered by the youth of America. 1,500 colleges throughout the nation are being converted to the war effort. All branches of the armed forces need the trained minds of youth. In consultation with faculty and advisory officers, students are guided to the specialized training they need for war work. Virginia's Dawn Patrol, composed of voluntary students who are eager to equip themselves for advanced military training to follow. This is the spirit of young men today. Naval ROTC units throughout the country train thousands of students.
I'm being joined by Daniel Lachenmacher, who is one of the co-hosts, at least for the last two or so months, of Complete Liberty podcast, Wes Bertrand's show. And Wes and Daniel and I have been doing a roundtable on a variety of subjects. But recently, Dan appeared on the anti-war radio show with Scott Horton. And Scott's show, I think, Daniel, is very, factual and factually oriented. And the interview that you did with him was only about 20 minutes, and I got the sense that you wanted to take it a little bit more into this issue that I'm talking about in this current episode of School Sucks, which is obedience. And the three places where I've heard obedience being described as a virtue are, well, school, the military, and in religion. And from our past conversations, I know you're somebody who has a fair amount of experience with that. So can you just talk a little bit about your background and what your situation was?
Absolutely. I've got, I think, all three of those categories pretty well down pat, Brett. I was raised in a very conservative religious home, and yet not enough so that I went to a private religious school. I still had government education for 12 plus years, so I got it there. And then a couple of years after I graduated out of the government education system, I joined the military, and I had obedience as virtue taught to me in a whole different way than I had ever experienced before.
The trifecta.
Exactly. Unfortunately, all three of those were at work in my life, and now, I don't know, I guess maybe too much of that is what helped bring me to the breaking point of realizing that that's just not a valid moral framework.
Indeed. And I know that on Scott's show on Anti-War Radio, he was very interested in your background and really what you had done over the last several months, because it's a very unique story. And I don't think that, you know, even Scott Horton, who does a show entirely focused on being against war and the horrors of war and the immoral nature of war, I don't think that he had ever encountered anybody who had your specific situation. So even though I assume that there's a fair amount of overlap between that show and Complete Liberty and Complete Liberty and my show, I was hoping that you could just recap what your experience had been and what you had done to basically exit the military over the last few months.
Well, what I did, and it's a sad thing that more people don't realize it's out there as an option, but I filed a request within the military, which is something that the military powers that be afford for you to do, which is to be granted status as a conscientious objector. The real brief overview definition of that is simply somebody who has a moral or ethical opposition to war across the board, not just a specific military conflict, but in general, they are opposed to war on moral or ethical grounds. So I filed this request back in May after really a couple months of preparation with some lawyers and other folks at the Center on Conscience and War, which is a nonprofit that exists essentially for the purpose of helping people through this very tedious process of trying to get out of the military as a conscientious objector. And thankfully, that is something that was successful for me. And so on September 11th, just a week or two ago, I was finally released from the military and granted that conscientious objector status.
The other really interesting thing about this, when we take it back to public education in America, is that our system, our public education system that's existed in its modern form for the better part of a century, is pretty much a carbon copy of the system that existed in the now defunct Prussian Empire. And the system in Prussia was basically instituted by the military brass and the leadership during the middle of the 19th century to make good soldiers, to turn people into obedient followers and authority worshipers. So, you know, to take your experience, both having 12 years of public education and this experience in the military, would you say that there was consistency from one institution to the next?
There most definitely was. Even just in some of the format that you see of how things are taught, in a, you know, a classroom style setting, or whether or not you're in a classroom, but that whole idea of one person up front who's just feeding the information out to a mass of people who are often not recognized as individuals, which is part of the problem, but the collective that is there to learn. And it's very much just a transfer of information is what's deemed by both the military and, you know, government schools to be seen as education, simply by relating information and having the supposed learner be reciting that information back through rote memorization. That's viewed as education both in public school and in the military.
So in the essence of that basically is that your mind, your individual mind, instead of being used for, you know, your own reason or pursuit of your own goals or being used in accordance with your own values, basically becomes a sponge, if you will, for the agenda or the bad or the violent ideas of somebody else or some other group of people. Is that fair to say?
Oh, most definitely. That accurately characterizes it. Your opinion, your take is not what's important. What's important is that you've memorized the information that's been given to you and you're regurgitating it back properly, and that you're therefore acting in accordance with that information without question.
So what was it that brought you to the point, Daniel, where you looked at your situation and you said, there's a rule here that I need to break, that I need to get out of this? What was the tipping point for you?
The tipping point for me was really the time that I spent down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, at what are called the detention camps. I don't think camp is a very fitting word for that type of confinement, but it's what's used. And so while I was down there, I experienced such an emotionally volatile environment that was filled with so much hatred and so much anger, and literally people who were sometimes separated only by a chain link fence and that wanted nothing more than to kill each other. And just seeing that day in and day out, I can't say that I came to the right conclusions while I was down there, but it started the process of having me think about what were the dynamics at play that would create such a situation, that would foster such animosity and keep it perpetuating. Because after having been down there, I realized that it didn't matter which side you were on. If you just took at face value what you experienced there, whether it was from inside a cell or whether it was from outside the cell, you would just be polarized to really want to kill the other side, which both sides revel in that. Both sides take advantage of that.
And, the reason why I ask you that is because this situation, because what you did is somewhat unique. You know, I think about so many, you know, young people and even adults that I converse with that are caught in this process of rationalization about what they're participating in, whether it's, not just the military, but government or political participation in general. And I basically, on my show, I just beat the topic of politics to death with like 160 minutes spread over three episodes. But what I'm getting at, I guess, is when you found yourself at Guantanamo, and you initially started to be uncomfortable, or you initially started to question what you were involved in, did you find yourself at any point, however brief, in process of rationalizing what you were doing?
Oh, absolutely. I even came home. I mean, as I was leaving out of that place after like 6.5 months down there, I came home rationalizing in my own mind why it was necessary that I did and participated in what I did and participated in while I was there. And I came home spouting those answers to family and friends and the very few, but the few people who did actually question me on it and, were kind of unaccepting of the fact that, wait, you were involved with that? You were okay with that? I was adamant about my rationalizations. And I think the fundamental one was simply that, well, I was doing what I was told. Because in my own mind, when the question came up and I asked myself, do I know why this person should just be held here indefinitely? I didn't have an answer myself. And yet I rationalized it by way of, I've been told that this person is that bad and that somebody somewhere has information that says this person needs to be kept here in this way.
So somebody who is better decorated or better, supposedly better qualified to make those decisions had made those decisions, and the onus or the impact was not on you personally. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. That in my own mind at that time, thankfully I've since left that behind, but it came down to I don't bear the personal responsibility for my actions in this situation because I am simply being obedient.
So I think it's fair to say, and you can let me know if you disagree with me, but I think so many people have that voice in their head. I think, you know, we take in reality and we see what goes on, whether we're in the military or we're just a so-called citizen of the United States of America. And for so many of us, for so long, there's that voice that rationalizes what we see and what we experience and what we're taking part in. So I guess the next question for you would be, what ultimately silenced that voice for you, which would subsequently lead to you taking action?
I would say first off, it was encountering the ideas of Ayn Rand through her novel Atlas Shrugged, and then really beginning an exploration of libertarian ideals on the whole and of morality that is related to the non-aggression principle, the non-aggression axiom, that to initiate force or fraud against somebody else, that is the ultimate moral failure. And as I came to encounter those ideas and explore them more, it, even after I'd kind of accepted some of those, I still had trouble assimilating my own personal time in Gitmo and my own actions there because it was so personal, because it would have such a cost on my own conscience to admit that I bore personal responsibility for the way in which I perpetrated misdeeds in my time down there. And one of the crucial factors to processing my experience in Gitmo and specifically handling that issue of obedience as morality, which I think is the whole thrust of the show for today, was reading about and studying again the experiment that Stanley Milgram did. Stanley Milgram, after World War II, a lot of people had questions, and himself included, of how could these common German people who were involved, end up being involved in, you know, this Nazi regime, how could they simply follow orders and end up killing so many millions of Jewish people and others as a result? And so he sought out to do a study about obedience and, you know, what characterized people's level of obedience when they would or would not obey authority, to what length they would go, even if they knew it was harming an innocent person, to what length would they go and still obey authority if an authority figure prescribed them to do something. And so he conducted an experiment, I believe it was at Yale University, in which he took a group of volunteers, and they'd been screened, so these weren't people with like already pre-existing neuroses or something like that, just a wide sample of people. And he set up an experiment in which he had an actor essentially in kind of like an electric chair, in a chair in which they were wired to some electrodes. And they had a person who was supposedly in charge of the experiment, another actor wearing a lab coat who was playing the role of an authority figure. And they said that the person who was actually being tested as part of the experiment, who didn't know that it was, you know, what the experiment was actually about, would come in, and they were told by this authority figure in the lab coat that every time the person in the chair answered a question wrong, they were to administer an electric shock to them. And they were in separate rooms, but they could see the person in the chair, and they would play act as if they were actually being shocked. And each time as they got answers wrong, they were supposed to raise the voltage of the shock that they were administering. And he had done a kind of a cursory survey of his peers and of students and of others about what they thought, what percentage of people they thought would continue to administer shocks to what was written on the label as a deadly level, supposedly like 450 volts. And all his peers, all these other psychologists, these psychology students, they're like, you know, it's going to be just a very distinct minority of people with some type of pathological problem that would ever go to that high level and administer that highest shock. And what he actually found from the experiment is that even an authority figure who has no actual control, has no monetary control, has no control in the way that the military has over your life, or even a teacher over a student, just among adults, somebody who's seen as an authority figure telling you to do something, and something like two-thirds of the people involved in this experiment, simply because they were told to do so, would be looking across, seeing an innocent guy in a chair tied to electrodes, and they would administer a 450-volt, thinking that they were administering a 450-volt shock to that person, simply because of the power of obedience.
So this is the result of training, obviously, because most of these people, I'm guessing, that were participating in this experiment were college students. Is that correct?
It was the study was redone because it was so revolutionary. The study's been redone around the world because they thought, well, then this is just cultural. But they found, replayed again and again and again, you know, with all different demographics of people, that this was something that was repeated. But I do definitely think it's something learned, and that's something, it's a problem across humanity.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that we see, you know, despite what we're told in school, despite what we were told in church, and you and I have those two in common, and what you were told in the military, we see when this idea of obedience is projected out into a real world situation, even though, like in Milgram's case, it was completely simulated, we see that it is not virtuous whatsoever. But if we're going to just abstract, maybe back to principles, I know you mentioned Ayn Rand and objectivism. What kind of answer would you give to the question, like when somebody makes the statement, obedience is a virtue, why is obedience really like the opposite of virtue?
It's an abdication of personal responsibility, more often than not. And I will say, I wouldn't say across the board that just because you're being obedient means you're being unvirtuous, but rather just because you're being obedient doesn't mean you are being virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a key differentiation. And the reason being is that personal responsibility, that an action is right or wrong, not based on whether or not somebody told you to do it. It's based on an objective morality. Simply because somebody tells me to pull the trigger and shoot this person, that action that is wrong, killing, initiating force against somebody, cannot simply be made right simply because somebody else told me to. And it's completely removing yourself from the picture by trying to claim that, oh, this is right because it's obedient.
Indeed. So when people you know, present themselves, you've heard it, I'm a law-abiding citizen. You know, when you think about law, and certainly there are moral laws, there is such a thing as customary laws, but when people use the expression law-abiding citizen, basically what they're saying is if a stranger who doesn't care about me writes something down on paper and codifies it through some kind of arbitrary process, I'll do it. Which I think we can agree is not virtuous, considering that most of those things, beyond laws like don't hurt people and don't take their stuff, are really not designed to produce a more stable, rational, or ethical society, if you will.
They're not designed to be protecting any people's rights.
Indeed, and in many cases, they're doing just the opposite. So it's something that I've always been curious about when I hear people say that. I mean, you know, the obvious companion to law-abiding citizen is a, you know, tax-paying American. But this is a very good example of that sort of reflexive obedience, that these people aren't even thinking about what they're saying. They're attaching virtue to sort of being passively accepting of somebody else's rules that might work against them.
Very true. And the other way in which you see it is when you question authority, when you question authority figure, you know, a cop comes up to you and says, well, you know, you didn't make a complete stop at that stop sign. And you ask him, well, there was nobody there. And I saw that there was nobody there. And I slowed down to be careful. and who did I harm? The fallback isn't going to be actually addressing whether or not your action violated anyone's rights or whether or not it harmed anyone. I think almost, one could say almost assuredly, the fallback from my experience of people who call themselves police officers is the fallback is going to be, listen, I'm just trying to enforce the law. And again, that abdication of personal responsibility, the fact that they're just claiming obedience to a higher authority. And so it's not about them violating your rights by detaining you or by doing this or by doing that. It's about them being obedient to whether it be their chief, whether it be, you know, something that's written on a piece of paper, like you said. It removes that personal responsibility again.
So this abdication from personal responsibility is also a sort of self-sacrifice, you know, either to so-called leaders or maybe more appropriately rulers, or as it's more often stated, you know, at least in this country, and I'm sure that it's the case in other countries as well, to the collective or to what's often the very vague and cloudy term, the common good, that these are sort of noble or virtuous reasons for self-sacrifice, but nobody ever really considers what that means.
No, that's a huge connection that you made there with the idea of self-sacrifice. What does it mean? What does it say about yourself? And what does it say about how you value yourself if you're willing to set aside your own reasoning ability, your own thoughts, your own feelings on the matter, and say, well, you know, I'm not important enough. I'll just follow what she says, or I'll just follow what that piece of paper says. You're sacrificing your values on the altar of obedience.
But people would say that that's sort of a necessary means to an end, because there is a certain amount of self-sacrifice and abdication of self-ownership and personal responsibility necessary for participating in a society. Because if you didn't do these things, we wouldn't have the institution of government wouldn't be possible. And therefore, we wouldn't have roads and we wouldn't have water flowing into our houses. So again, when you expose these things, we're right back to the rationalizations I find with the conversations that I have. But what's interesting is that this meme of obedience that has just been so pervasive in so many cultures for so long, and for a long time it was accomplished through militarism. You know, if you go back to the ancient world or the idea of conquest, the militarism of places like Sparta was soon replaced with the obedience through religion. And, you know, in our modern society, it's really delivered to young people through this institution we call public education. And what's interesting is that the people who say this is necessary for things like roads and for things like water and sewage, that despite some tinkering and some slight advancements in those areas, those public services or those public works, as they would be called, are still being delivered in modern society in the 21st century the same way that they were in Rome 2,000 years ago, basically. So this obedience meme is so handicapping. Like, we don't even know what could be possible. People are so unaware of what can even be possible for a society or for a group of people trying to live together and cooperatively coexist, because they've transferred so much responsibility and leadership onto strangers. But with all the progress that has been realized in the last 2,000 years, we still aren't even aware of what could be possible as this sort of reflexive obedience just continues through time.
Very true. Obedience is a killer of creativity. I mean, you look at, in comparison, how the military goes about problem solving versus how a company like Google does it. And you read about companies like Google, and I really enjoy reading about, you know, business management techniques and some things like that, good ones that value people because the best companies do value people, and they value the talent and the insight of their employees, and they know that for them to be the most successful, for each of them to be the most successful, and thus for their company to be successful, they need to value those people, they need to get their feedback, they need to have them in on coming up with the solutions. Whereas the military, from boot camp day one, what you're taught is, okay, I'm telling you X is the problem, and I'm telling you you will solve the problem of X by doing A, B, C. And you are not to question, you are not to offer your insight, you are not to do anything but execute A, then B, then C, because you're told that will solve problem X. And you look at that versus taking a group of people and saying, okay, we think the problem is X, do you see that as the problem? And if that is the problem, how do we solve it? And getting feedback from people and valuing people and not just looking for blind obedience from them.
What this recording will ultimately become is like the latter half of the most current episode of my show. But this discussion that we're having will be following me talking about an experience that I've had recently with working with public school students on the SAT. And I used to hate tutoring this test. It was just so repetitive and so mundane. But the more I got into it, and the more experience that I got working with standardized tests like the ACT and the SAT and the SAT2, and there's a few others, the more I realized that these tests provided opportunities for kids to learn about themselves as learners and to develop logical reasoning and critical thinking skills. And I actually had a young kid, he was a senior in high school yesterday. We were talking about approaches to math problems, and he said, you know, I just can't think like that. I've always been taught that, you know, here's a problem, here's the formula, plug in the numbers and solve the problem. And there is nothing beyond that. There is no involvement with you. Like, you're there to stick this formula and this problem together and produce a solution, kind of like this assembly line process. And when you were describing the experience of being in the military, like the problem is X and the solution is ABC, it was almost identical to what this young kid was describing to me yesterday.
As if people were machines, that you simply input the right instructions and that's the only way anything good will come out.
Right. And the right instructions are never written by the person carrying out the operation.
No.
Right. They must be written by some type of authority. And the obedience makes that process so possible, and so not just possible, but so perpetual.
It just shuts down people's thinking abilities, their analytical abilities, their creative talents, and it leaves them feeling like that student did, like they are deficient. That if they don't get something in the way that it's told to them, like that student, I can relate, because at times I've had somebody try and explain a math problem to me, and lo and behold, you know, in class, I don't get it. And the way in which the teacher, the professor, whoever explained it, it just does not click in my mind. I bring it back and I sit down in it with somebody else in the class, or, you know, with my wife, and try and have them explain it from a different perspective, and suddenly the light bulb goes off, and you go from feeling like you're deficient because that person, you raise your hand in class and you get, I already explained it, weren't you listening? And no recognition that there can be different ways of thinking about a problem, and therefore different ways of coming up with an effective solution. Not that, you know, you can come up with 2 + 2 = 5, but that how you organize that problem and going about solving it can have more than one method.
Yeah, and I think about myself and my experience too. I never even would have considered the idea that I was intelligent, probably until I was like 20 or 21 years old. Really, because of the failures that I experienced during public education, that I could not fit into that mold. And it was even to the point where I had left classroom teaching and I had become a sort of a private in-home one-on-one or small group tutor in the Boston area, that I was still terrified of certain content areas, and math was one of them. And this was maybe, I don't know, three plus years ago. I was very clear with, I had started working for a tutoring company, and I said, listen, I can do the verbal part of this SAT, but I am really just terrified of the math. And kind of building on books that I had read about a person like Albert Einstein, he only became more than a patent clerk because he was so willing to violate other people's rules. He was so willing to move around well-established conventions that people thought were just law. And he said, no, you know, why are we approaching problems the same way some guy in Britain did 200 years ago? I want to try something else. I want to break his rules. And when I started to, you know, even just with something as simple and as stupid as the SAT math, when I started to apply that thinking, within a matter of a little more than a year, I had managed to develop all these unique strategies that when I went and talked with other tutors, they had never thought of before. And this is from somebody who never considered themselves to be very good at math. I was always very apprehensive about anything mathematical. And really just through that sort of rule breaking or trying to come up with alternative strategies than those that had been pushed on me when I was a student, I kind of considered that to be a pretty big success, to the point where I was able to yesterday, and you know, really for the last couple of years, actually lead these classes that are focused on the math and deal with these approaches that would have just been so foreign to me. I mean, I think I see these kids' faces so often, and I see just how turned off they are to anything that is considered educational or enlightening because of their public education. And I sympathize with them and try to, whenever I'm working with kids like that, which is really, I find, most kids, to remember myself when I was in that position. And it's very crippling, you know?
Yeah, that instead of having been empowered as a learner and been encouraged to seek out methods and have somebody patiently work with you to find out how it's going to make sense for you and take that time to do that, it was probably that mechanistic model of, listen, I gave the instructions, you should have written down the note, and if you don't get it, you're deficient.
Indeed, absolutely. So Daniel, just to wrap this up, I would be interested in hearing from you, just based on your experience, what kind of advice you would give to people who aren't just, you know, in the military, but find themselves sort of under the thumb, or maybe more appropriately, under the boot of these obedience expectations, really young people who are in school.
I would put out there the fact that you do not have to judge yourself by other people's standards. And even just identifying that and articulating that thought in your own mind and questioning it, perhaps not accepting right off the bat, you know what, maybe, you know, this Dan Lockmacher guy and Brett and his whole School Sucks podcast, I don't know, maybe you're not sold. But think about and entertain the notion, what does it mean for me as a person? What does it mean for my life if maybe I'm not wrong simply because I think differently than what somebody says? And maybe what defines what's right and wrong isn't based simply on this person who claims to be an authority, but maybe there's some other explanation. And explore in your own mind. Listen to some of the thoughts that you have in response to that, some of the feelings that you have in response to that. Because ultimately, I think people do recognize themselves as being individuals who have value and therefore who are not defined by other people. And if you take the time and actually allow yourself the possibility of even entertaining such notions, it can prove to be a powerful force for change in your life and really a great source of happiness.
Well, I think that's definitely well put. You know, as long I feel like we really, what I was really going for is to expose this idea of obedience as something that is not a virtue, despite what we learn in school, despite what people might learn in their church, and despite what some people might learn in the military. It is a crippling and degrading idea that is pushed upon us, that limits us, that forces this kind of self-sacrifice. And again, the abdication of self and self-ownership and personal responsibility that never leads anywhere good, because when that happens, people become just, you know, shells that can be sort of puppeteered by others, by people who, if they want to hold those strings, are usually sick and dangerous people.
Exactly. That was just going to be the last thought I was going to toss out there. Maybe you do have so much doubt yourself, and you can't place yourself in that position to say, well, maybe I'm right about something. Before even going there, like you hit on with the idea of the puppet master and the puppeteer, look at the incentives. What incentive does this authority figure have for me to obey him or for me to obey her? You know, this pastor gets up there and says, you know, I need to give 10% of my income to the church. Well, what would be the benefit to him for me to do that? And maybe look at it from that incentive perspective, if nothing else.
And just to continue along that same track, when we think about obedience, look at the, instead of incentives and disincentives, let's use words like carrots and sticks. The carrots for obedience are nothing. That you don't even get a pat on the head. But it's a system of sticks. All sticks and no carrots. You know what I mean? There's nothing in it for you. It's certainly there, you know, at least in the realm of government or political participation or so-called citizenship, there's the illusion of benefits for obedience. But this is really a system of all sticks and no carrots.
Very true.
So, all right, Daniel, we will leave it there, and I'm sure you and I will be picking up again soon on Complete Liberty, but I really appreciate you joining me and having this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Brett.
In the last episode, I talked a great deal about the philosophy of Ayn Rand, a philosophy of rational self-interest, self-esteem, and valuing your own life. Daniel mentioned it today as well. I encouraged you to think about her philosophy, while her body of work might not have been perfect, as more of a garden than a graveyard. The philosophy that is imposed upon all of us in public school, a philosophy of sacrificing oneself in one way or another to an imaginary concept called the common good, is certainly the garden that the tree of evil that I always talk about grows in, as well as the graveyard for millions. In the mid-1800s, in the Prussian Empire, which became Germany and then the Third Reich, as I mentioned before, rulers were concerned about the efficacy of their military forces, because the problem that they had identified was that the soldiers that they lined up to fight in an effort to expand their empire would often turn and run. They would desert the war effort because they had this inconvenient ability, you know, inconvenient in the eyes of their rulers, to think for themselves and to act in their rational self-interest. Because when a human being finds themselves in a situation where bombs are landing around them and bullets are whizzing by them, the only rational thing is for them to preserve their life. They realized that they had just been given a gun and told to shoot strangers that they had never had any personal problem with in their whole life. And that didn't make much sense to somebody who could think for themselves. This was a big problem for rulers who wanted to expand their empire. And when they heard about these desertions, they would probably get incredibly frustrated and say something like, "These selfish and stubborn people, all they seem to care about is preserving the only life that they'll ever have. Don't they understand the importance of me annexing Austria? How will I ever be able to extract resources from the Austrian people for the benefit of me and my friends if the people here only care about continuing their own life?" So, anyway, the Prussian leadership was able to develop a system that would solve this problem by replacing that rational self-interest with an allegiance to the mythical idea of the common good or the collective benefit or the good of the nation-state. This system would include training methods designed to get a naturally wonderful, naturally creative, naturally reasoning human being to sacrifice themselves to a fantasy that the rulers had created. That system today would look very familiar to you because you spent 12 years in it as well. It was transferred here, almost exactly the same form, to do almost exactly the same thing that it had done in Prussia. To train children to be obedient. And once that training in thoughtless obedience had been completed, the leaders knew that they could install in the minds of those people whatever fantasy was most convenient for them at the time. When those children became adults, they would engage in a continuous process of rationalization to explain why the world that they lived in had to remain exactly as it always had been. But what I would invite people to do, or at the very least to try, is this. All of that energy and imagination and creativity that has to be channeled into coming up with rationalizations for the destructive and murderous behavior of strangers who don't care about you. Try to redirect some of it, that energy, that creativity, that imagination and thought, into the pursuit, or at least into the process of discovery of a better world, where the lives of people like you and me do not have the goals, the agenda of murderous, megalomaniacal sociopaths superimposed onto them. In the 20th century, tens of millions of people died in war because of this obedience. And today, in the 21st century, there's many who will still say that those wars were necessary. But in a world where these forms and these systems of mass obedience training did not exist, war would not only be unnecessary. War, this industry of mass murder and self-sacrifice, would not only be unnecessary, it would be impossible. Thank you for listening. Please check out Daniel's website, warisimmoral.com, as well as the work we've been doing on Complete Liberty for the last couple months with Wes Bertrand. And until next time, as the kids say, peace.
All the stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now. All the wars that were won or lost somehow don't seem to matter very much anymore. All the lies we were told, all the lives of the people running round, their castles are burned. Oh, I see change, but inside we're the same as we ever were. Living on a thin line, ooh. Tell me now, what are we supposed to do? Living on a thin line, ooh. Tell me now, what are we supposed to do? century nearly gone. What are we gonna leave for the young? What we couldn't do or what we wouldn't do. It's a crime, but does it matter? Does it matter much? Does it matter much to you? Does it matter?